spread that unquestioned assumption to the real authorities of any culture. And that makes a lot of sense to me. And so one of the things I've been trying to do with a lot of my work, a lot of my life, is to question a lot of the assumptions that do guide our lives. And one of the assumptions I think that really guides our life is that the world is based on competition, that nature is red in tooth and claw, and that everyone is always at their throats, and everything is about competition. And this is in contrast to, this is a very Western idea, and it's been the Western idea. It's certainly true in the Bible, and it's true in the selfish gene, to bring it up to date. It's true in capitalism. It's true in pretty much everything about this culture, from its most fundamental to its most over the top. With this notion that everything is always about dominating. And that is in contrast to everything I've ever heard about indigenous ways of being on the world, where you perceive the world not as consisting of resources or consisting of everyone at each other's throat, the dog-eat-dog world, which is just a terrible phrase, but instead that the world's a giant symphony, and that your role is to figure out your role and then to play that role at the proper time. And that's a vastly different way to look at the world. And I'm going to throw in something else here, which is that they say it takes you 10 years to change your mind. And the person who wrote that said that found himself arguing very strongly anti-choice. And then about 10 years later, he found himself arguing very strongly pro-choice without any discernible transition. And it's just, that's how I think we change our minds. It just takes a long time and to metabolize new information. And that was true for me. It took only a couple years, though. The first time I heard that evolution may be based primarily on cooperation, not competition, I thought, man, that's crazy. Everybody knows that evolution is primarily based on competition. And it was John Livingston's where I first read it. And then it was about a couple years later that I found myself no longer able to conceptualize that all of evolution is based on competition, but instead that cooperation is a central driver. And for me, one of the lines I used to say quite often is that I can prove that evolution is not based on strict competition in one sentence if you give me a couple of semicolons. And that's those creatures who've survived in the long run have survived in the long run, semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings, semicolon. You survive in the long run by actually improving your habitat. And that makes perfect sense to me. And there have been many people, especially there have been scientists over the years who have gotten very upset at that. And then I've been thinking about this again lately because I had a conversation with a couple of very, very intelligent and very good biologists who disagreed with me on the cooperation thing. I'm not saying that competition plays no role, that certainly if we're both starving to death and there was an orange on the, they give you a little piece of orange after your meal to as a breath freshener or something. I said, if we're both starving to death and we have this one piece of orange in front of us, then yes, we will be in competition for this because we're going to die without it. And he said, that's my point exactly, is that we are always all at the verge of starvation, but that's what competition does. And that's how natural selection works, is that everybody is exploiting their niche as much as they can and driving everybody to the point of resource scarcity, because if there's any resources left, they will take them. And so basically everybody is at the edge of starvation and everybody is at the edge of everybody's at the limit of some resource, otherwise they would expand. And I said, that doesn't make any sense to me. And then I thought about it a long time, and I thought, this doesn't even make sense as a reproductive strategy. That as a reproductive strategy, would you rather have 80 million bison without enough grass, or would you rather have 60 million bison who are all relatively healthy? Which is a better reproductive strategy? Basically, what you want is, I mean, from a purely reproductive standpoint, ignoring everything else, what you want is for the males to be healthy enough to produce viable sperm, and for the females to be fat and healthy enough to have babies. You don't want them starving. That doesn't make sense as a reproductive strategy. So I'm talking about this with a biologist friend of mine who is agreeing with me more or less. And then he writes back to me and he says that the three things that are required to perpetuate your species are growth to fill a niche, reproduction, survival. You have to survive in your habitat. You have to be able to reproduce in your habitat, and you have to be able to have your numbers grow, because if there's only two of you at first, eventually you got to fill the niche. And I wrote back and said, there's something missing from this, which is you have to take care of the land base, because if you're harming your land base, then you won't last either. And before I go any further, I have to say also that I can argue that evolution is primarily based on cooperation. Other people can argue it's primarily based on competition, but the truth is that it's neither. The truth is that life is far more complex than the concepts we put over the top of it. And it is, we could never design a computer program well enough to take everything into account and come up with, oh, it's 47.3% cooperation and 46.9% competition and whatever else percent chance. I mean, that's not how it works. The universe is infinitely more complex than that. But having said that, I was thinking that we always hear that the way evolution works is that there will be some niche in a community that needs to be filled, and then there will be some resources that can be exploited, and some creature will move in, exploit those resources, and then that's how it stays in that community. I think that's the wrong way to look at it. I think it's a completely wrong way to look at it. I think the way to look at it is that the larger community, the forest here, for example, has a need, and it needs to find someone who will fill that need, and it will reward them for filling that need. And so it will, to use words that don't really work very well, but it will essentially audition for that role. So if it has a need for lots of calories, or actually calories aren't important for the trees, if it has a need for lots of nutrients to come into a forest, it may say, well, do passenger pigeons do that? They come in and they poop, and they may get an audition. Do salmon do that? They come in and they die. And who will fill that role? And whoever fills that role will be rewarded for doing so. And it seems to me that is a more accurate way to look at the world. So that's one thing. I just want to lay that out there. I'm still developing this thought, and I might actually try to write a whole book on this at some point. It's striking me as really, really important. And one of the reasons it's important is because how you perceive the world affects how you behave in the world. And what this whole selfish gene notion is, it's so clear to me, is a projection of the capitalist mindset onto the natural world, and a naturalization, an attempt to naturalize the exploitative and destructive behavior. And think about this. If you perceive the world as consisting of other beings you're in competition with, and you must strive to be the best at exploiting, you will behave one way. And if, on the other hand, you perceive the world as needing things from you, and your job is to try to figure out what are those things so you can best help the world, and in so doing, you will be rewarded by the world, your behavior will be grossly different. And now, one more thing I want to bring to this is that central to the whole way science is supposed to work is that you, as well as doing experiments, one of the other things you do is you develop a model, and then you apply that model in the real world and you see how well it works. So, for example, the model could be that I believe that when you drop things, they fall because we have this gravity thing that is out there. And we can get more specific on how gravity works, or we can try to figure out how it works or anything. But the first model is, okay, so I have this. The model works in the real world. I dropped something and it fell off. Or we could say, no, gravity doesn't work that way. That if you really believe, if you believe very strongly that belief is more important than gravity, and you can try to model this behavior in the real world, and you can jump off a cliff. And this will give you negative reinforcement for that particular model. And that's how you learn that model doesn't work. And then my point is that we have all of human evolution with most of the cultures living such that they believed that it is our job in nature to figure out our role and to serve the land. And those lasted for tens of thousands of years. And now we have another model we're working with, this model where what you do is you exploit as best you can, and you, everybody steals as much as they can from everybody else, and there is no cooperation in nature, but instead it is all this ruthless competition for who can propagate their genes. Now, we have been projecting that model onto the real world. How well is that model working? What is happening to the real world as this one? See, part of the thing is, too, Richard Dawkins understood this. He didn't understand that he understood it, but he understood it. In The Selfish Gene, he has this one thought experiment where there is this creature, a bird, I believe it is, who can not self-groom, but instead grooms others. And there are ticks come in. And if the ticks don't get groomed off, then the birds die. And so he said, let's have a model where there are two groups, two types. One of them is what he called suckers, who groom each other constantly. And that works. And the entire community is doing great. And now you have another one, which is called cheats. And the cheats don't groom anybody else, but they accept grooming. And so he says, what happens if you introduce a few cheats into this community of suckers? And what happens is that the cheats do very well. And they start growing up because growing in numbers, because they don't have to expend any energy grooming anybody else, but they're getting groomed because all the suckers are grooming them. And so they do great. The suckers slowly lose out, and then there's more and more cheats until the whole community collapses. And he wrote this as an argument for why you can't have a community based on cooperation, because as soon as you have a cheat, the whole thing falls apart. I read this in about 1990, and I remember thinking, don't you see it? Don't you see what you've just done? If you look around, what you see is one cheat who is going around taking everything from everybody, and the entire world is collapsing. Richard Dawkins just made the best argument possible for natural selection being based on communities, individuals and communities taking care of the entire community and playing their role in the community. And what happens when cheaters come in? It's what we see. The world gets destroyed. So my point in raising all this is that ultimately, I mean, yes, it's always nice to be closer to the truth. And I believe that the dominant culture's murder of the planet shows that competition, that there has to be more than just competition in terms of natural selection, because we are quickly selecting everybody out. But there's another point here too, which is the worldview that we have is in itself maladaptive, because the worldview itself, the belief that the world is based strictly on competition and that we all need to outcompete each other, and that's what everybody else is doing, this naturalization of that imperative within capitalism, within patriarchy, that itself does not lead to survival. And so that mindset, I would suggest that that means that that mindset can't be true, because you can't, because the mindset, again, is maladaptive and does not lead to long-term survival. How we experience the world affects how we behave in the world. Unquestioned assumptions are the real authorities of any culture. And the notion that it is natural to not give a shit about any of your neighbors, but instead to simply attempt to exploit all of them, is one of those unquestioned assumptions that desperately needs to be questioned.